Well, I'm not going to go into any big line of talk tonight. We've got too good a speaker. From what I've heard, I've met him before, but I don't think I ever heard him speak. We have Blackie from San Francisco. Blackie?
My name is Bob Sitton, or Blackie, whatever you want to call me, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't get this way overnight. When I get up to make a talk or get into discussion, I have to remember that I have paid my admission fee, I paid my dues. The 25 and a half years that I drank, preceding Alcoholics Anonymous. I started when I was 13 years old on Dago Red and Grapple. I celebrated my 13th birthday for 3 days and nights. And I couldn't even take a drink of water for a week afterwards. The only thing I could do was sneak out to the milk house and get a big cold jar of milk. I didn't keep on drinking after that. I drank occasionally at school dances and different affairs. And it seemed like that no matter when or where or what I drank, I couldn't get enough. And needless to say, my folks weren't very happy about it. Because whenever there was any kind of a party or something, somebody had to watch me. Very early in my young life, I started carrying a bottle. I went through high school. I was kicked out twice for bootlegging in high school. By the time I graduated from high school in 1933, I had a very serious drinking problem. I was young, I was very energetic, I was very active, I was a star in athletics in my school. I was the only man that represented Yuba City Union High School in the Northern California Conference at Chico. I was High Point that man that day, and I won all the honors for the whole state for the school. When it come time to graduate, they found out that I didn't have enough credits in mathematics. I hadn't passed algebra in 3 years. Several of the teachers got together, and for 6 or 7 nights, they raked me over the coals, and 3 disinterested members of the faculty gave me a test, and I squeaked through with a D-. That was so that I could appear at the assembly in the gymnasium when they passed out the diplomas, when the State Athletic Association presented the school with the trophies. That was the only reason. I don't think there were very many people in that school by the time I had spent 4 years there that really loved me as a student. I caused too much trouble. After the graduation, I couldn't get into the gym quick enough, the locker room, to take off my cap and gown and get out the back door. And my buddy and I laid down behind a big hedge and drank a quart, not a fifth, of Gordon's gin. While the reception was going on for all the students and all our projects that we'd made in school were exhibited in the school cafeteria, and they had a buffet and some more medals were presented. I was supposed to get 5 or 6 medals for my prowess in track. I was passed out behind this hedge. I never quite lived that down. I felt so chagrined that I couldn't face people around my hometown, so I joined the Army. The Army at that time was pretty rugged. That's when they wore the old wool uniform and wrapped leggings and everything, and I got shanghaied up to Fort Missoula, Montana, the 4th Infantry. I was in that outfit 6 weeks, and they found out that I knew how to drive a truck. So they put me in charge of the only truck that we had for our company as a truck driver. At the same time, the non-coms in that outfit found out I had a way somehow of procuring alcoholic beverages almost any time of the day or night and whenever need be. Needless to say, in a very short time, I became their runner. And almost every day that there was any duty, I was sent to the motor pool to clean the trucks. Of course, I had this one truck, and I had a couple of guys. I'd give them a bottle of wine, and they'd make the thing shine like $1 million. And I'd go out and on a foray for liquor for the rest of the guys in the outfit. I followed that pattern through 13 years of service. I never got in trouble because there were too many guys in trouble with me. I went through the war, 41 and a half months in Alaska, 22 months in the combat zone. I was hurt 5 times. Blown 50 feet from that a tank mine. I had a brain injury. I got a piece out of my spine, 17 pieces of shrapnel in both legs. My feet and legs crossed it 3 times. I was never hospitalized for any of these things. I had 2 Navy corpsmen taking care of me in the dugout. I came back to the States, and I wasn't fit for combat duty. I was the first sergeant when I got back. So they shanghaied me to an MP outfit. Made me post police and prison sergeant at Fort Bliss, Texas. I had 500 Germans under me, about 250 GI prisoners, 150 Italians, and 150 Mexican girls who worked in the laundry. In 9.5 months, I made the psycho ward 3 times. I didn't know what for. This wasn't just drinking. I had this head injury I didn't know about, and I had this spinal injury I didn't know about. I was later operated on for both. I got a medical discharge the 31st of July, 1946, from William Bowman General Hospital. The certificate of the, I was discharged under Section 1 Army Regulation 615-361, which in the medical handbook reads, mentally and physically incapacitated for further military duty. Combat service connected. My certificate of disability for discharge, when I was boarded at the hospital, read nervous anxiety acute, nervous hysteria, and emotional instability. If that isn't an alcoholic, I'll put in with you. But my real problem didn't start until I got out. When I got back to Marysville, which is across the river from Yuba City. My mother had since moved to Marysville and gone to work for a newspaper there. I had a little over $19,000 that I'd gotten when I was discharged. Incidentally, I bootlegged and sold this PM whiskey overseas for $90 a fifth to the officers and $45 to enlisted men. And we ran a 4-5-6 game, bar booty, blackjack, low ball, name it, we had it. I figured that I had a good drunk coming. And I did. And I proceeded to go through that money. It didn't take very long. Finally, one morning, my mother was sitting in the kitchen, and I thought she had gone to work. I used to wait until I heard her go out the front door and down the steps. I could hear her going to Story and a Half House to go catch the bus to go to work across the river. And as soon as she left, I got up. I slept in a little apartment under this Story and a Half House. I'd made the thing myself. It was in the laundry and right off of an old garage. And when she left, then I'd get up and scrounge for a drink, and if there wasn't a drink or any money, I would take some groceries or something down to Chinaman's and trade them for wine. Because she had cut my money off. She had it, I think, $900 left in the bank that belonged to me. So she's sitting there, and she's drinking a cup of coffee and smoking a cigarette, and she's crying. I asked her what the trouble was. She said, well, she says, I can't go to work and leave you here today. She says, I've got to talk to you about your problem. And I says, well, okay, what do you want me to do, go back to the hospital? And she says, no, she says, you just got out of Palo Alto. That's the Laughing Academy down at Menlo Park there for the veterans. And She says, there are a couple of people over in Marysville that have a cleaning shop. And she says, they're both about your age, man and wife. And she says, they used to have a drinking problem, but they're sober now. I said, well, that's fine. She said, well, I want you to talk to them. I said, well, okay, what do you want me to talk about? She said, well, I want you to talk about drinking. I said, oh, hell, I said, my drinking doesn't bother me. I said, it's just that I'm so nervous. I said, I have to drink. It's the only medicine that I can use. And I'd get a bottle of a fifth of wine and a pocket full of goofballs, and I'd go around, and no matter where I went, I had this bottle of wine with me. I carried it every place. I went to a funeral one time with a thing stuck under my shirt. So she says, you want to go in the trucking business in Sacramento and haul grain? And I said, yes. I said, I did it before, and I said, I want to try it again. I said, I can make about $45 a day for myself and hire two guys at $35 a day, and we can make some money this fall in the rice. And she said, well, she says, you have a little over $900 left. And she says, I'll give it to you if you'll talk to these people and convince me that you want to do something about your drinking problem, because I can't go to work knowing that you're here and that you might be drinking. And then Dick comes home, that's my younger brother. He's 6'3" now and weighs 180 pounds. I'm almost twice his age. She says, I can't go to work and leave you here and know that Dick might come home and, she says, you pull some of this judo stuff on him or something that you learned in the service. I know 15 ways to kill a man with my bare hands. I was an instructor in unarmed defense and in the commando school at Fort Huachuca, Arizona before I got out of the service. I had a little of it in combat too. And at any time, why, I might flip and try to use some of this. It's been done. You've heard of people doing it, going berserk. And she says, you might burn the house down. You might attack Mr. Morrison. He was a preacher who lived two doors from us. Incidentally, there's a big levee goes down behind the house there, the one that broke when they had the flood up there. And I used to walk across the railroad bridge and come down that levee and slide down the levee into the garage so that I wouldn't have to walk by Mr. Morrison's church. I did that for almost a year. I wonder why. So I agreed, and very conveniently she went to Eastern Star. It was on a Wednesday night. These two people came over and they brought the big book and they brought some literature. And they were fine looking couples, and about, I think he was 34 and she was 29. I was 32 at the time. And she'd been sober 2 years and he'd been sober 3.5. They read the book to me. I wouldn't read it. I wouldn't read the literature. They read the literature to me and they explained about AA and how it worked. And I was thinking all this time, well, my God, if I got to go through all this rigmarole that they've got, those silly 12-step, why any little kindergarten kid can do that? Just to stay sober. I can't imagine this life without alcohol. I said, I've told myself I've got to drink. It's the only thing I know. The only place I got any friends is where I go is where I drink. So I dummied up and I went to a meeting the next night in the Lutheran church in Marysville, and there were 7 men there and they were all older than I am. They were all people I drank with in bootleg days. One was a judge, a former judge, that I'd helped pour into his bedroom window more than once from the back end of my pickup truck. And the other one was a local doctor who had been the head of the city and county health department. And his son and I used to steal absolute alcohol from him when he had a pharmacy and mix it with grapefruit juice and juniper berries and everything and sell it to the other kids around school. I thought, if I have to be like these old fuddy-duddies that have all burned out from drinking and carousing and raising hell and sit around and drink coffee and talk about my drinking days, I don't want any part of it. And to top it off, A guy got up and gave a 35-minute dissertation on God, and he was a former minister that had gotten kicked out of a four-square gospel church or something like that. No disparaging ideas about the church. But he'd been kicked out of this church after being a preacher in the church for 7 years for bootlegging. Boy, oh boy, if this is what I got to put up with, I don't want any part of it. But I'm going to go along with it because I need that money. So I come home, and on the way home, I got me a small bottle of wine to sip on that night. And I could manage to sneak two or three bottles of ale into the house during the day when my mother was at work, and keep a bottle of wine down in the basement, or in my shelter down below, so that I could have a few drinks when I went to sleep. But I went to two more AA meetings sober. Now, I want to tell you this because I was exposed to AA when I was 32 years old and when I had a very serious drinking problem. When I landed in the Veterans Hospital the morning of July the 9th, 1952, 6 years later, I'd been hospitalized 57 times for acute alcoholism in that ensuing 6 years. I'd have been in jail over 200 times for drunk and disorderly conduct, and what have you. No felony, thank God, no 502s or anything. And I was a sick cookie. I'd been drunk for 7.5 weeks on wine and goofballs, and the only thing I can remember eating was a couple of rotten tomatoes and drinking a couple of quarts of buttermilk in that length of time. I went from 187 to 156 pounds. I looked and acted like a zombie. Now, I couldn't say that I didn't know, because I did. I'd been exposed to AA. I'd had the book read to me and the literature read to me. It was so impressed upon me that I had the address of the New York office pasted on the back of my driver's license and then sealed in plastic. And I carried that thing that whole 6 years, and when it come time to get my driver's license renewed, I wouldn't relinquish it and get a new one because it still had that address on it. But do you think I'd go to AA? Not me. I'm too smart. I'm an expert sergeant, personnel sergeant major, prison sergeant. I won the war. I got medals and everything to prove it. I got citations from the general, from the Alaskan Defense Command headquarters, General Buckner himself in his own handwriting. You mean to tell me a guy that can be personnel sergeant major for 31,000 troops can't manage and run his own life and drink? Not me. But there I was. After I was in that bat factory for a little while the last time, the doctor came over one Sunday, and I was in pretty sad shape. I was out in the hallway, and I had a hold of a broom and a mop to hold me up. And I was leaning against the wall, and I was red as that lady's dress there in the back, and I was perspiring so that the water was running out of my slippers, and I was shaking so bad that I couldn't talk. I had to bite my tongue. And this doctor comes up to me, and he takes off his glasses and stands there and looks at me. He says, "Your name's Sitton, isn't it?" I says, "Yes, sir." He says, taps his teeth with his glasses, you know, and he says, "You don't remember me, do you?" No, I don't, doctor. I'm, you know, trying to stand still. And what the hell does this guy want, you know? I had never seen him before. He says, "Well," he says, "you know," he says, "in the little hall down here, little room off the hall down here, about 50 feet," he says, "one morning," he says, "you knocked me down and broke my glasses and my upper plate about 2.5 years ago." He says, "Here it comes, boy, he's going to give it to me now." I'd been in the tubs all night, and I'd had an ice pack that night and everything, and they give me paralyzed, they done everything to me. Or no, they wouldn't give me any paralyzed, that was it, they cut me off. I thought maybe I could angle one out of him if I put on a good enough act, but I didn't have to because I was just, you know, like this. And I said, "What in the hell? Why didn't this guy leave, you know? get the hell away from me. I was standing out there with that broom and mop because I didn't want to be out in the day room with the rest of the patients because they were all ding-a-ling, see? I didn't want to have nothing to do with them. I couldn't stand them. There's one guy, he sat there and he took newspaper and he tore it in absolutely perfect inch strips like that until he had a big pile of them. Come to find out later, after I got discharged, this guy used to be a broker over in Alameda or Berkeley, and he went south with about $140,000 of the company's money that this brokerage firm he worked for. And this paper he's tearing up is ticker tape. His name is Bell. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him or not, but that was his little act. And I didn't want to be with people like that. I didn't want to be where they took your matches away from you and give you an old bathrobe without any belt and a pair of socks, where they didn't have any toilet paper, where you didn't have any toothbrushes, and where they had steel mirrors bolted into the wall that you couldn't smash. I've still got scars from trying to smash them. I didn't like that, where you were regimented and where they lock you in a cell at night, and when they feed you, they give you your meals on a paper plate with a paper cup and a paper spoon, and when you're done with it, you do what you're damn well pleased with it. And you got a grating about this big around in the floor with inch hole squares, and that's your toilet. And for a bath in the morning, they come in with 2 gallons of disinfected water and throw it on you. And they never open the door unless there's two guys there bigger than you are. And nobody comes in the cell unless they come in to drag you out. So, I wasn't one of those kind of characters, you see. I was different. Damn right I was different. I was an alcoholic and I knew it. The only thing is, see, I'm in there in this Laughing Academy, and the question is, now, am I nuts or am I not? If I'm nuts, I'm like those guys. If I'm not, what the hell am I doing there? I must be an alcoholic. Well, what do you want to be? You want to be a ding-a-ling or you want to be an alcoholic? What's your classification? Well, this doctor had me because at that time they were boarding the guys over in Ward 16 and they were committing them. I didn't know it, but I was already committed to Mendocino State Hospital. I didn't know it on paper. I just hadn't appeared before the judge and gone through the formality. They were going to send me to Mendocino State Hospital for the rest of my natural life. And the VA would pay for it. I would never get out again as long as I lived unless I was dead. The VA had their belly full of me. In this hospital, I'd been in maximum security in Ward 17 up in the violence section over 50 times in the 7 trips there. That's not counting all the other maximum security wards I'd made in hospitals in Panama and Honolulu and Japan and Bellevue in New York, Kings County in Brooklyn and El Paso, Little Rock, Arkansas, and Sacramento, Marysville, Yuba City, Roseville, and Los Angeles, and right on down the line, Mexico City. It don't make any difference if you name it. I've been there. But this doctor had me pegged because he says, that's all right. He says, don't worry about this deal. He says, you were blacked out when it happened. He says, I realize that. But he says, now you know what I'm talking about. He says, you got a drinking problem. He says, I got Ward 1 over there. He says, I'm over here today by accident. He says, not really by accident. He says, I was sent here for a reason. I didn't know it myself until I saw you. But he says, you're dying. I'll give you 4 hours to live in the condition you're in. And he says, we got this ward over there. We got 7 guys over there. He says, they're going to AA meetings in Palo Alto by themselves, on their own, because they want to. And he says, they're sober for the first time in their life, because they want to be. Not because they have to. This is different. Because they want to be. They want to do something about their drinking problem, but they have to do it themselves. He says, you have to do it yourself. If you want it, okay, you let me know, and he says, we'll have him come get you. He says, you can come over in the ward. And then he told me about Mendocino. He says, you think you're going home tomorrow, but you're not. He says, your clothes are already packed, and your papers all made up and everything. But he says, if you want to go to AA, he says, you let us know, and he says, Monday morning we'll come over and get you, and he says, we'll put you in Ward 1, and he says, we'll give you a try for 6 months.
I said, well, I don't know what I want or not. You know, I'm sick. I said, I need some medication. He said, I know you need some medication. He says, I don't believe in giving these kind of shots that they give, but he says, I'm going to order one for you. And he says, after I give it to you, he says, I got some other treatment I'm going to give to you so you won't die. He says, you can't live in the condition you're in physically now. My pulse rate was 133. They had me go down to the nurse's office. She gave me this shot. She had to hold me while she gave it to me. And then I leaned in the doorway, and he came down, and he said, take off your jacket. And I took off my jacket, and he said, put your arm up in the doorway as high as you can, your left arm, and look out the window. I put my arm up like this, and he hit me with a needle about that long right in the heart. When I woke up, I was in bed in a quiet room. They had tubes in my both arms and both legs and one up my rectum. That's the only way they could feed me or give me medication. I couldn't swallow anything. I couldn't eat anything or absorb anything in a normal manner. I was too dehydrated. My system was too shot. Alcohol actually doesn't hurt a person's system. Alcohol is a medicine. It's a narcotic. It's a depressant. It's also a hypnotic. But alcohol as such doesn't hurt the human system a bit. It's only the overindulgence of alcohol which results in a person's loss of appetite and coordination, which causes their system to go to pieces and doesn't function properly. The body doesn't get the right nutrition. There's 10 times more calories in alcohol than there is practically any other food because it's made out of sugar, but there's no vitamins. There's no bulk. And when you consume enough alcohol over a long period of time, it burns up all the sugar in the blood. Your liver doesn't work right. Your metabolism goes off, and your fluid balance in the brain is haywire. That's the reason you have delusions and hallucinations and the delirium tremens. But you eliminate the alcohol, feed the body properly, and you'll get back into shape eventually. You recover from alcohol quicker than you will from any other narcotic. The body repairs itself. It's a marvelous thing. The fact that I'm standing here alive and sober tonight is evidence of that, even though I have been in the hospital since I've been sober several times for cirrhosis of the liver. It didn't really bother me until after I'd been sober 5 years, but it was because of work, overwork, and too much nervous strain that my liver started kicking up, and it hit me in my central nervous system and sent me to the hospital. It's worse than any DTs you ever had. But after I got out of there, he sent a couple of patients to talk to me, and they convinced me that I needed AA. At first I told them I didn't want it. I didn't need it. I just was nervous. I needed to get out of there. But they convinced me. I won't go into it. It's too long. I got too many important things I want to tell these people that might be new here. I'm not telling anybody what to do or how to work AA. I'm not telling them from the standpoint that I'm an authority on AA or anything else. I'm only an authority on drinking, that's all. It's the only thing I know anything about. Since I've come into AA, I haven't stopped drinking as such. I've just learned how to live without starting again. That's all we do. No one speaks for AA. AA speaks for itself right here in this book. There isn't anybody can work the program for you. I can't get sober for you, or I can't stop drinking for you, or I can't get drunk for you. No more than I can eat your food and breathe the air that you breathe every day. We're all the same inside, whether we like it or not. We're all created the same. We've all got the same bodily functions. We've all got practically the same amount of blood. Our food is assimilated in the same manner. We breathe the same air all over the world. It doesn't make a difference whether you're white or black or green or yellow, or whether you're an atheist, agnostic, a Buddhist, a Christian, a Democrat, or what you are. We're all the same. There isn't anybody in this room that is any different than I am as far as alcohol is concerned, if he's an alcoholic. Alcohol has had the same effect on you as it would on me. If you're an alcoholic, if you took a drink, you'd eventually get drunk. I don't recommend anybody try it, but if anybody doubts it that much and isn't willing to take a damn fool's advice, the book says the only thing you can do is step out to the nearest bar and try it for a little while. See what your results are. If you're not convinced that you're an alcoholic,
And if you're not convinced that you get sick, and that your life is terribly unmanageable, that you lose everything you've got, materially, spiritually, morally, physically, and every other way, the book says, and I go with the book, that it's time you were convinced, if you haven't convinced yourself. Because this is a do-it-yourself program. Who are you kidding? I talked to a guy today. It was pitiful. The guy's sober 4 years. His wife is in the hospital and they can't see his kids and I don't know what all. He quit his job or got canned or something. So he decides that he'll get drunk. Now his car is impounded. He can't get his car out. His wife's still in the hospital and she's sicker than she was before. He still can't see the kids and he can't get any money because the bank won't let him have any. And I asked him, I said, what in the hell convinced you? How did you convince yourself that you needed that drink? He didn't have an answer. I said, nobody forced you to, did they? Anybody beat you up? Pull a gun on you? Threaten to kill your wife or let her die? Well, I said, what did you take the drink for? He said, I guess because I wanted to. I said, that's a pretty poor excuse, isn't it? Because you wanted to? I said, well, was it worth it? He said, not right now. Well, I said, if you didn't learn anything from this lesson, I said, you better go out and start all over again. But if you didn't learn anything, it wasn't worth it. But if you learned something, it was worth it. I said, I can't do anything for you now. He said, well, talk to me. And I said, I'm talking to you. I talked to him for 40 minutes. I held up another appointment just to talk to the guy. He says, I want you to come up to my apartment. And he says, well, we'll watch TV and I'll make some coffee. And I said, look, buddy. I said, you make me miserable as hell. I said, I actually get sick when I get around somebody like that I have to babysit with. Because it isn't doing me any good. And I don't see how in the world I can do you any good. I said, you're down here at the club now. You're around people that are sober, that are alcoholics. I said, you can sit here and drink coffee and talk to somebody, but we get up there in that apartment, I haven't got a thing in the world to say to you because you're still half drunk. As long as you've got a drink in you and you're thinking about drinking, I said, I cannot communicate with you whatsoever. It's absolutely impossible. You have cut the line. You cut the umbilical cord. I have no contact with you whatsoever. The only contact I have with you would be something on a material, physical, personal basis. And I says, this is not that kind of a program. I says, I'm not hard-hearted. I says, I love all these drunks. Some of them I don't like what they do. I love some of them more than others. I love some in just an ordinary way, and there's some of them I love least of all. But I still love them. God help them. I pray for them. I pray for people. It's the only way I can stand them. While that guy's sitting there yakking at me and blowing that stinking old scotch in my face, the secondhand scotch is terrible, you know? But I sat there and I took it because, after all, somebody had been awful patient with me. Somebody listened to my BS for a long time before I got sober up here, even after I was sober physically. And I prayed for the guy. I just said, well, God, if I can't help him, you show this fellow how to find a way that he can get help. Because I know if no human being can help him, I know God can. But I'm not God. I tried playing it a couple of times and it didn't work. It backfired. I found out I'm just an ordinary, simple human being who drank too much too long. And at the wrong time. But I like the way I live now. I like my job. I've been working for a bank now for 4 years. I'm bonded for $1 million and insured for $1.5 million. 8 years ago, my mother wouldn't trust me with 15 cents to go get the Sunday paper. I bet you don't know why. I'd steal the paper and buy wine with 15 cents. And then she'd have to pay the grocer for the paper I stole. But this is only through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that this is possible. I wasn't like this all my drinking life. I had a couple of little businesses of my own.
turn a cassette over to side two?
Of my own, but I used to make some pretty good money at it. I used to make $1,500 a month at it, just accidentally. I'm trying to get back in the business now. Maybe I will in another year or two, I don't know. What God wants me to do, I will. If He wants me to keep on being a security officer in a bank, I will. It doesn't make any difference. I've held this job that I'm working on now under duress several times because two or three people had it in for me. They couldn't stand to see a wino working in a bank with them and have friends. Now that's a peculiar thing. They were jealous. The only way I stood this boss of mine was one thing that a preacher taught me a long time. This guy in church I avoided by sliding down the levee came over and talked to me one Sunday morning, sat on the side of the bed and bought me a drink, bought me a half pint of whiskey. He said, you know, he says, when you got these hates and resentments, when you feel mean or bad towards somebody else, you're cursing them in your heart, you want to feel like you want to kill them or something, he says, why don't you pray for them? He says, it seems like somebody's doing something to you that they have no right to, but you don't have this coming to you. He says, maybe this is the law of retribution working. Maybe this is something you did 15, 20 years ago. He says, I'm not talking to you as a minister now, I'm talking to you as man to man. He says, just as father to son. He says, I feel like you're my son. You just come home from the war and you're sick in your mind, your body. You're beat down. You're hopeless. You don't know where to turn. You know, you can't turn to God, you can't turn to your mother, and you can't turn to your fellow man. You turn to the Bible. And he says, when you feel this way about other people and about yourself, he says, pray for somebody else. If you don't know how to pray, he says, make up some prayer. He says, when you pray for that person, he says, you're putting God between yourself and that person. And they have to hurt you before they have to hurt God before they can hurt you, and vice versa. And that's what I did with this fellow tonight. He tried to can me four times. Once while I was in the hospital, he even went so far as to send a letter to personnel on it. I still pray for the man. I sent him a Christmas card this year. Him and his wife. With a Christmas prayer on it. A pair of hands like this folded in prayer in a blue sky, and it's got a gold star in it. Since he got that card, he has avoided me. He won't even look at me. And I've met him in the concourse behind the teller's cages four times, and he's turned around and gone back rather than face me. But I don't hate that man. I can't. Because if I hate that man, I will hate any good that's in me. Because there is some good in me in something. He's been good to his wife. He's very kind to her. She has cancer and doesn't know it. But he is one of those people who has such a personality that nobody likes him. He has to be the absolute omnipotent supreme being no matter what he is doing. He's been demoted twice since I came to work there. And I was partially instrumental in his demotion, even though I had no part in it myself. I didn't have a word to say. It was only what he was trying to do to me, and personnel wouldn't put up with it. Because if they put up with it, then it would affect all the rest of the help. And they couldn't hold still for it. But I couldn't quit my job because of how this man felt. I had to praise the guidance and wisdom. I'll show you how the program works. I had to choose between this man's personality and what he was trying to do, and I had to choose between the principles that I had learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what is good and what is right. I had to stand up for my dignity as a human being. I had to retain my self-respect by not making this a personal matter with him, but stick up for my principles, stick up for what I believe in, stick up for what I believe God would want me to do. I'm very serious about this thing of what God wants me to do. God, good, faith, love of my fellow man, how I should act and behave myself, how I should conduct myself. If I made this a personal matter, I would be worse than he was. And as a good friend of mine who was an attorney in San Francisco said, he said, Bob, He says, you have to think of this man as a very, very sick man. He's sick emotionally and he's sick spiritually. He says, if you put yourself in a position where you have personal antagonism against this man and you let him antagonize you, he says, then you are worse than he is. He says, don't do it. He says, stand up for what is right and what is good and what you've learned. He says, these are principles that have been taught to human race ever since the beginning of time. Thomas Jefferson once wrote, when he was asked to lay the groundwork for the Declaration of Independence, a little sort of parable that he, a kind of a little prayer in the law that he lived by. He assimilated everything that he knew as an attorney, as a statesman, as a doctor, and he studied theology, he talked to ministers, he talked to priests, he talked to everybody in 4 days, trying to find out what he was going to do to lay the groundwork for the Declaration of Independence. Because all the people in the colonies at that time were depending on him. And he knew that he was only a human being, and he asked for God's guidance. He got on his knees that night, and he didn't say any formal prayers. He just talked to God like I'm talking to you now. He just asked him to show him what to do to help all these people, not to help himself. He says, let me be the instrument to set these people free. He's drinking coffee the next morning at breakfast, and eating a piece of toast, and reading a letter. And he picked up the envelope, and he turned it over, and he scribbled on the back of it, when the Supreme Being created the universe and formed matter out of nothing, he impressed certain principles upon that matter from which it can never depart, and without which it will cease to be. Since man depends absolutely on his Maker for everything, it is necessary that he should, in all points, conform to his Maker's mission. This will of his Maker is called the law of nature, or God. And I like to add to that that there isn't anything that walks, that crawls, that flies, that swims, that faces the earth, that grows on the earth, that can get away from that from the time it comes into being and from the time it passes into it. Nothing. I think we all have a destiny. We're all searching for one thing. We've been searching for it ever since we had any choice of our own. When we came in this program, we took step 3, consciously or unconsciously. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. When we got down to step 3, it says, became willing to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Whether we can turn our will and our lives over to the care of God or not, we don't know. We do it to the best of our ability. If we don't say God, we say the program or AA, or we turn it over to a sponsor or some higher power. But immediately as soon as you do that, you have made your last decision. You don't make any more decisions from then on. They're all made for you. But you're given the choice for the first time in your life. You have the choice of whether you're going to drink or not drink. You have the choice of whether you're going to get mad at somebody or not. You have the choice of whether you're going to pray or not. You have the choice of whether you're going to go to an AA meeting or not. You have the choice of what you're going to eat, what you're going to wear, whether you're going to be good or whether you're going to be bad. And it's all within you. I wrote down a little something one time, and somebody had asked me, I've been on the hospital and institution committee for about 6 years, 7 years, and been going to all these places all over and talking, and I'm reading the Sermon on the Mount, reading the Bible. I went back to church after 32 years. I don't go all the time, but I go when I feel I need it. I haven't joined because I think I have a deeper, more profound obligation right here to the people in AA that love me and the ones that I love, because that's where my life comes from. That's where my supply comes from. That's where this faith and hope. Faith is things hoped for but not yet seen. These are the things I believe in. These are the things I trust in. I never doubt it for a second. I don't doubt that I'll work this program. I don't doubt that anybody else can. If I doubt it for 1 second, then I'm doubting my own ability to do it. I can't doubt it. This program works for anybody. Anybody that wants it. Anybody that wants to work it. Anybody that wants to make the effort. But the individual must want it. And he must be willing to make the supreme sacrifice of giving up himself. Self-will. There's nothing tougher in the world. If you don't think so, when you go home tonight, go in your bathroom about 2 o'clock in the morning, turn on the light, and stand there and look at yourself in the mirror, and say to yourself, well, Joe or Mary or whatever your name is, are you doing the best you can? And look yourself right in the eye, and don't flinch. If you flinch, you got any reservation, if you've said anything wrong that day, if you've hurt anybody, if you've used your own self-will, if you've been envious or jealous or any of these other things, you'll know it. And this same preacher told me, he said, if you can look at yourself in the eye in that mirror without flinching or having a reservation for a full minute, he says, you are a saint. He says, I've been a preacher for 38 years and I can't do it. But he says, we can try. We can try. All we have to do is try and be willing to try. Be willing to love somebody or something. It doesn't hurt to love anything or anybody. Love is a terrific thing. It's held mankind together and people together when nothing else would. It's helped a lot of people over some rough spots. I'm not talking about the physical love or any of these other things that we talk about. I'm talking about the spiritual love. The love of one human being for another. The love of all people for all things. If we didn't have that, I know we wouldn't be here. You people weren't driven here with a whip or nobody said that you've got to go to an AA meeting tonight or else or any of that kind of stuff. That is the spiritual love. That is the spiritual act of coming to this meeting because you want to be people with like yourself. You want to help somebody. You want to be helped. You want to share what you have, what you found. This gift that is so precious that money can't buy it. You will get out of this thing what you put into it, what you've earned. Not what you want. You won't get what you want, but you get what you need. I want everything I have. I haven't got everything I want. But I don't want to let go of what I've got. But I have to share it. If I'm not willing to share it, then I'm selfish. I'm selfish to the point of being grasping and conniving. Of shooting the old alcoholic angles again. Of telling people what to do. Telling somebody else how to run their life. The book says when you get those kind of feelings, sit down with a piece of paper or get off and talk to yourself and take a little personal inventory. Ask yourself, what step are you working now? Whenever you become confused or upset or mad, just stop. Say, what step are you working now? And if you keep on doing that, you keep on practicing, you'll get in the habit of doing it. You can't help it. It's there all the time, constantly. And the more you practice it, the more it works, the better you feel, the easier things seem to go, things fall into place. We're ordinary human beings. We got problems to face every day. We have to deal with other people. We have to go outside and make a living. We have to go buy groceries, do our washing, get the car fixed. Mechanical things break down. Other people don't understand us. Well, what the hell? They didn't join AA. We did. They aren't working the program. We're the ones that's working the program. And when you get confused and upset and bewildered and everything else, ask yourself, what step am I working? What are you doing about your own problem? Not somebody else's. That'll take care of itself. These people will be brought to you. Your own house is in order. Why? You won't have any trouble. It's like the book says, it's very obvious that you can't transmit something you haven't got. And when you get it, nobody will have to tell you. You'll know it. You won't be out on cloud 99 either. But you'll get a wonderful sense of peace. Of peace. Tranquility within. There might be jumping and jiving and everything else going on around outside of you. The kids might be raising hell, and there might be a storm raging, and everything else sound like hell broke loose. But inside, you'll say, well, I accept it. This is what is meant for me. I can be at ease with myself in any situation if I want to be, because I know He is with me. I know that I have found my place in life. I know that I love my fellow man. I know that I'm doing the best I can. Staying sober just isn't enough. I know lots of people are just staying sober, and I wouldn't trade places with them for all the money in the Bank of California where I work. I got a boss that way. He's got 20 of those, but he's the most unhappy man you ever saw in your life, because he can't stand himself. When you can stand yourself sober and like yourself the way you are and be content with what you have in your surroundings, then you have peace of mind and serenity. No one will have to fail. No law. This little piece is entitled Freedom. Liberation or freedom is not gained by lectures, magic, or sacraments or liturgies. It is only obtained by the deliberate search for one's inner self. Most effective is right thinking and right behavior or action, with a sincere desire to become what you could be. Sin does not offend any God, but only the person that commits it. Each person's sin is his own. Sin is an awareness of a separation or an apartness from your Creator or God. God does not punish anyone, but we punish ourselves by not trying to live according to His teaching. There was a nurse sitting in a ward in an orthopedic hospital, and a little boy, 11 years old, was in a cast. He was in a cast from his waist up to his chin. He was paralyzed. The only thing he could move was his mouth and eyes. And there was a dance going on that night for the staff, and there were a lot of young interns there and everything, and this girl wasn't too old, and she was pretty good looking, and she was thinking how nice it would be to be at that dance. And the lights are going off and everything, and you could hear the music coming across the court from this little foyer where they were dancing, and the laughter and the tinkling of the glasses. As the nurse turned out the light and bent down to kiss him, oh, he says, Miss Mary, he says, there's some cake in that drawer I saved from dinner. He says, enough of both of us, and he says, it's some nickels. And he says, if you go get us some coats, he says, we'll have a little party right here. And he says, I know you'd like to go to that dance. And he says, if it wasn't for this cast, he says, I'd get up and take you. And she says, suddenly the tears were hot, and she turned her face away. And she says, the dance seemed very far and very unimportant. Thank you.